Good day, everyone, and welcome to another RBW Wealth Wisdom podcast. Our team here at the RBW studio comprises myself, Selwyn Gerber, Donovan, and Stefan, and our very honored and distinguished guest, Professor Shlomo Ben-Artzi. Professor Ben-Artzi has a long and very impressive resume, and I'm going to not repeat all the details because you can get them online, but for the purpose of this discussion, just know that he is one of the leading thinkers in the area of behavioral economics, behavioral finance, and what one might call the intersection of economics, psychology, human instinct, and many other things that kind of come together at a single spot, which is where he spends most of his life figuring out how we can improve many aspects of people's financial lives. And with that, Professor Ben-Artzi, I welcome you to our studio and invite you to tell us a little bit about yourself and this area that you've specialized in so brilliantly.
Thank you. You know, like most things in life, there's a set of random events that make you end up being a wealth manager or a professor or a behavioral economist. So I guess the audience probably is looking forward to hearing how, since I was born, I knew that there would be a field called behavioral economics, and that's exactly what I'm going to do for the next 50 years. But it was actually more of a set of random events. So here's the story, how random this actually ended up being. So when I did my undergrad in Tel Aviv, I'm from Israel, I have a very bad back. So I figured out I need a job that has flexibility. So that was actually the main reason I ended up actually as an academic, because I figured out I can work more or less, you know, I can relax on the sofa and read research papers. So that's why I decided actually to go get a PhD. So you could call that a pretty random decision. The next one is I land in Ithaca, New York, and I meet Richard Thaler, the recent Nobel laureate, and I suddenly understand that a lot of the economics that I've studied in my undergrad doesn't really relate to real human beings. I mean, we don't save enough, we eat too much, we have a lot of self-control issues, we're very myopic on occasion, we look at how the stock market is done today, even if we have 40 years until we retire and need the money. So, you know, if Richard Thaler was at the University of Chicago at the time, where he is now, maybe I wouldn't have been a behavioral economist. And I think a lot of people, probably a lot of listeners, are very successful in whatever they do. But I would suspect that a lot of it might actually be like a random path. But anyway, I ended up actually as a behavioral economist, and I think I've been very fortunate because there is an opportunity, you know, to nudge people, as Thaler and his collaborator on the book Nudge, Cass Sunstein, would call it, to nudge people to do what they really want. And I'll talk briefly about savings, and I think it's a really important domain, obviously not the only one, when people might want to save but somehow fail. You know, we could think about diets and all sorts of other issues, or, you know, screen time and wasting less time on your phone. But we were fascinating with savings because, first of all, it's an economic decision, and second, we kind of felt that it might be a relatively easy domain to actually crack the code and get people to save more, unlike other domains like dieting, which I think are a lot more complicated. So we came up with a very simple program, embarrassingly simple, which we call Save More Tomorrow. And it originated around 98. With a mid-sized manufacturing company in the Midwest. The employees didn't make much money. that were struggling to pay the bills. We offer them to save more. And they all say they'd like to do it. Now, that's critical because we have to understand that we're not trying to nudge people to go to a place they don't want to go. They kind of all said, we want to save more. We just can't do it today. We don't have the money. We can't pay the bills. You don't understand how difficult it is. So we've actually said, why don't you save in the future? And it's very easy for people to think about doing the right things in the future, whether it is spending less time on their phones, exercising more, eating healthy, spending less. It's all easier to think about after your vacation to Hawaii, you will start saving money and you will start exercising. And that's something behavioral economists have many labels for, whether it's present bias or a fancy one like hyperbolic discounting. But our current self has a lot of issue with temptations. Our future self, for some reason, has a big supply of self-control. So we use that. And we virtually told people save in the future, and kind of almost everyone said, oh, we could easily do that. Now you got two challenges. One is when. So we thought it'd be easier if they do it when they get a pay raise. You make more money, you take a little bit of the extra and you save it. You don't have to cut your spending. You don't have to feel the pain of losing the ability to go out. And there's a lot of literature on kind of this notion of a status quo bias, or how we feel that taking away something is a loss and how sensitive we are to losses. So now we have a program. People will save more in the future when they get a pay raise. But as we know, nobody would act on it. So the missing ingredient was, how does it actually take place? And that's where we put it on an autopilot. So we use kind of the cognitive laziness, or kind of the easiest thing to do is to do nothing. So we virtually use the inertia to our advantage. If you do nothing, once you're in this program, it's an autopilot. We're going to take off. We're going to cruise. We're going to land it. We're going to make you save more automatically every time you get the pay raise. And the people, the employees at this company quadrupled their saving rate from 3.5% to 13.6% over 3.5 years. Now there are about 15, 16 million people in the US on this program. And this is not so much to brag about the success of the program. It's really the tip of the iceberg. When you think about using behavioral economics, behavioral insight, and a bit of economics finance to help people reach their goals. And again, I think it's really important to realize that the program is really designed to help people reach their stated goals. We weren't trying to, you know, suggest different goals that they didn't care about. We weren't trying to manipulate them to save more than they wanted. They wanted to save more. They didn't know how to do it. We just used the behavioral insights to help them get there faster.
Terrific. Well, thank you. That's mind-blowing in its simplicity and in its power. That's just absolutely phenomenal. Thank you so much. By the way, I want to tell you, Professor, that before you came here today, I read your book called Save More for Tomorrow. And as a result of that, we made a decision in our company that we'd automatically enroll new employees in the 401k program with the maximum participation, that it was the default position. We didn't tell anybody about it, but all new hires are automatically enrolled, and we invited all the existing ones to follow on. And we're already students who put your basic thinking to, it's autopilot. You come and you become an employee here. And you're on autopilot to put the maximum contribution into your 401k as your default. So thank you for that on behalf of our employees and their children, who won't have to support them to that extent at some point in the future.
I think one of the things that this kind of autopilot programs do, if you think about people in an airplane, they're all going to take off. They're all going to cruise. They're all going to land safely. So it actually takes away the inequalities. And when you create those autopilot 401k plans, what happens is management, senior advisors, secretaries, the janitor, everyone will end up saving, men, women. It closes the gap across demographic groups. So it's not only making people save more, it really makes everyone saves, which I think is really important. And some of your clients might have small businesses that they've very successfully built over the years. And as they actually set their own 401ks for their employees, they might want to think about it as well.
Professor, when we had the pleasure of listening to you at the Waldorf Astoria event with RVW clients, one of the most interesting examples that I thought I've heard was the example between the banana and the chocolate when you talked about the present bias. Can you go a little bit more into that and how the psychology of that works?
Sure. So it's a classic experiment. You ask people if, you know, they'd like to have bananas or chocolates next week. Let's say there's a class today and a class next week, and you say, next week I'll bring bananas and chocolates. What would you like me to bring? And most people, like 75%, say they'd like to have bananas, whatever is the healthy choice. Right. Our future self has a lot of self-control. Like, he or she can do the right things for us. And then the week passes, and you come back, and you tell everyone, I'm really sorry, I forgot what you asked for. But just in case, I bought enough bananas and enough chocolates. So have whichever you like. And suddenly about half the people flip. So instead of 75% going for the bananas, 75% go for chocolates. Only 1/4 would go for the bananas. Our current self lives in the here and now, has a lot of temptation, almost no self-control, and tends to eat unhealthy, not exercise, and not save money. And this is what we call a present bias, or we have fancy terms like hyperbolic discounting, or you could just think about immediate gratification as a simple, you know, label for this. And there is something here to be done, which is whenever possible to kind of engage our future self. The future self will go to the gym. Now, so what's the missing component? Because, you know, people sign up for the gyms and then they never go. We need also to find a way to automate the activity. Right. So in the case of savings, it's a bit easier. You sign up to save. Someone can automate it, take money from your bank, from your paycheck, put it into savings. Dieting, exercising is a bit more difficult, but it's a powerful tool, in a sense, engaging our future self to reach our long-term goals.
Right. And speaking of automating, one of the things we found most effective with our 401k clients is we spoke about, you know, automatically enrolling people into the 401k plan. But we also noticed auto escalation every year, maybe just increasing it by 1%, also has been pretty effective. From all of your studies, what are some of the more automated tools or the nudges that you spoke about have been also more effective in terms of increasing savings?
No, I think automation and kind of gradually increasing savings over time is really critical. And we know how to make 401k plans successful. If you automatically enroll people, even at 7%, they don't opt out. And then you could increase saving rates by 2% per year. Within 4 years, they'll be at 15. There's no need to stop at 10, actually. There's no need to start at 306. So if you start at 7, you go to 9, 11, 13, 15, you're really changing the financial lives of those participants, because as normally in an automatic enrollment plan, they'll be saving 3%.
Right.
And maybe they'll be going up by 1% a year up to 6. We could make them go to 15 very quickly. So those are really powerful. Now, we also have to remember that behavioral economists are not magicians. So kind of this automation works really well we're not going to find a lot of nudges that are as effective, because these are kind of the super nudges, if you want to call it.
Absolutely.
So there'll be other nudges in cases where, for whatever reason, automatic enrollment is not the right solution. But we should remember that those would not be as powerful.
In terms of personalizing wealth management, of course, the big challenge for all of us is not so much managing the money. That's actually, certainly for us here at RVW, the easy part. The really difficult part is, not the difficult, the challenging part, is to educate people into how markets work. That's really the issue. And so we think of ourselves as kind of counter-cyclical educators. When the market's going down, we're telling them, don't worry, markets don't fall forever, and companies don't lose their value indefinitely. And what you really are victim of is what we call mass psychosis in the short term of market stampedes by manic, depressive, bipolar, investors who go through bouts of fear and greed. And then when the market's going up tremendously, we remind them of the Buffett quote, which is trees don't grow to the sky. And we don't get these kind of returns every year. And if we did, you'd have the whole gross national product of Japan or something in 20 years if it compounded at this rate. So we think of ourselves as counter-cyclical educators, and a lot of what we do is educating people in the normal volatility of markets, and that's unfortunately a reality. And many people, despite all the education, just unable to deal with the fact that volatility is the price you pay for the tremendous returns that long-term equity holders have had over time. Professor, is there a final word you would share with our listeners on if there was one thing they could do to improve their own financial situation over time? If there was one piece of advice that you could give them as a takeaway, which is what we try to do with our podcast, what would be the single thing that you would say to people? If you just do this, or adopt this approach, it's likely you'll be far better off financially over time.
I would probably say delete all of the stock apps from your phone. Now that Apple allows people to delete even what's called native apps, the apps that come with the phone built in, I think we just get too much information. We get scared too much. We buy high. We sell low. There's really no reason for anyone who is busy with the kids, with the job, with a spouse, with friends, with hobbies, to waste a millisecond a day looking what the market is doing. There's absolutely nothing good that could come from it. The idea of investing for the long run was always good, still good. So that would be probably my suggestion, and maybe just a little fun anecdote about, kind of this entire issue of attention, because those phones consume our attention. And I think in the financial domain, it could be actually in a very negative way. I'm probably as bad as, using the phone too much and kind of trying to answer text messages as I'm walking and as I'm crossing streets. I don't remember which city it was, might have been Las Vegas, but I recently actually was traveling, doing things on my phone, looking, down as I'm walking, and the traffic light was actually on the floor. They actually put lights built into the sidewalk at the ground, you stepping on the lights. So you virtually, with a limited attention, as you walk and look at the phone, you actually don't accidentally cross the street on the red. So it's a really little change to the information environment from having a traditional traffic light hanged, 10 feet above ground, because we used to actually walk looking ahead as opposed to looking down as we're looking at our phones. And I thought it was very, very clever. And it's not very different from actually, the issue about deleting the stock apps. It's all, we live in a world with limited attention because so much is coming our way. And the two things here, whoever provides information, even if it's a traffic light, would have to put it in our face when it's relevant information. And whenever it's not, we should find ways to actually free our little mental bandwidth for what's really important.
Fantastic. Terrific. You've been absolutely great. Delight to host you. Thank you so much. And good luck with your research in all these fantastic areas that you're thinking about and penetrating. And we're standing by for more groundbreaking insights from you, Professor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast is not intended to constitute investment, legal, or tax advice. The ideas and strategies expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those recommended or implemented by RBW Wealth. Please consult and rely exclusively on your professional advisors.